The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and at 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with my roster of fund managers, analysts, and journalists, both on the ground in these markets that we're covering and also in the major financial centers, we examine emerging and frontier market investing, try to clear up some of the misconceptions that many people have about these markets, and suggest courses of action for you, the listener and potential investor. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and those that are maybe not so promising. By emerging markets, we mean, of course, the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, along with such other major emerging markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, I'll have a report on China and whether it is or is not headed for a hard landing, as many people fear, and also a look at the aftermath of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Now the smoke has cleared, so to speak, what's happening in terms of the equities of nearby European countries? By frontier markets, we mean in general the less developed emerging markets, countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, and Botswana. Today, I'll have reports on Vietnam, Ethiopia, and Nigeria. But China is where we start our tour of the horizon today, and it probably qualifies as both the largest and probably the most confusing emerging market as far as investors are concerned. We regularly hear that it's headed for a soft landing, that is, growth is going to slow down from the 10% or so average rate of growth we had for most of the last decade, or a hard landing where things will really slow down, or maybe somewhere in between. According to a Reuters report, its economy grew at an annualized rate of 7.4% in the first quarter of 2014, which was down a little from 7.7% during the last quarter of 2013. All Chinese official economic statistics, as most observers are well aware, should be taken with several doses of salt. But at the same time, there definitely has been a slowdown over the last few years. However, my next guest says the pessimism about China is unwarranted. I have Adam Sherpa on the line from Philadelphia, where he's lead analyst for emerging and frontier markets at FIS Group there. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Adam.
Thank you so much, Gavin.
Now, before we drill down to the basics about China, is it fair to say that there's probably more disagreement about where the economy is at the moment and where it's likely to go than virtually any other of the BRIC countries?
Perhaps, but probably only because China's so important that everybody has to have an opinion, even if they're not well-informed.
Yes.
Whereas some of the other markets like Brazil or Russia, even obviously they're very significant, they're not quite as significant in China. And you know, it's sort of like if you want to have any opinion on the global economy, you have to have an opinion on or some view on what China's doing, of course some view on what the U.S. is doing. So, yes, I would say for that reason. But I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to say as it's more misunderstood, just that the volume is louder when it is misunderstood.
That's a nice distinction there, Adam. So you said that you don't believe that the case for a hard landing is proven. Why is the pessimism by those who do feel that China is going to come suffer a nasty fall unwarranted?
Well, I feel like a lot of the arguments that you hear in the Wall Street Journal or the 24-hour infotainment networks talk about, you know, are dwelling on the drawdown of the growth rate. Well, what they seem to be missing is some basic math. The drawdown of the growth rate is a natural byproduct of the economy starting from a much larger base.
Yep.
But in fact, the economy is actually growing is adding more money to the economy this year than it was at its peak in 2007. But it's just doing so from a much larger base, so the rate of growth is lower. But the population growth in China is more or less flat. The World Bank thinks it's about 0.5%, and that may or may not include expatriation, which we can talk about later. But so this is real growth that's, you know, hitting the pocketbooks of the Chinese people. And so I think the hysteria over a slowing growth rate misses the true story of what's going on in the economy. The other point that some of the major publications and news networks talk about to prove that there's some big issue going on is that, you know, the economic restructuring argument. Well, I think this also misses the point. China, contrary to popular belief, has not been an export economy. Its net exports of goods and services has never been more than 9% of its GDP, because most of the value added of the components that it ultimately exports are imported.
Right.
First. So the actual value added of its exports to the economy has never been that significant. And it fell off long before the post-crisis restructuring. In fact, its exports on an absolute level fell dramatically as a result of decreasing demand from developed markets after 2008. So I think just that some context is important in terms of understanding what's really been going on in China, and the consumer sector has already been increasing dramatically and growing by as much as household consumption expenditures have been growing by as much as 15-20% a year over the past few years, up from a pretty steady base of about 9 or 10%. So there's the notion that there's some pending restructuring that could be dangerous and uncertain, I think, is designed more to sell news than to report it.
No, that's a very fair point, and I think that, especially the point about a much larger denominator, you know, that the actual base on which you're measuring growth is vastly larger than it was even 5, let alone 10 years ago, inevitably there's going to be some slowdown. Now, having said that, there undoubtedly has been a massive expansion of the credit within the Chinese economy over the last 4 or 5 years. A lot of it has been directed into what seem to be unproductive investments, such as property. There's the stories of the hundreds and thousands of unoccupied condominiums and the expensiveness of Chinese property. How much of that is justified? Is it fair to say that China does have a problem in terms of attempting to make more productive use of the investment it's making?
I don't think China has a problem, but property developers have a big problem. They're not going to be able to sell those houses for the prices that they expected, that they sort of sold their investors on, that they would be able to, and prices are going to have to come down. But demand for housing still outstrips supply, even though you have all these empty houses. But the prices will just have to come down, and that means there'll be some pain in property developers, and the future construction will slow down, and that will have follow-on effects for commodity exporters to China, whether it be in steel and cement companies in China, and you know, there's all sorts of massive effects that will happen. But this is not necessarily signs of a Chinese economic crash, because the property markets are not as integrated with the financial markets as they were in the United States and Europe 5 or 6 years ago. So the notion of using a Euro-American lens to view these statistics in China, I think, gives you a misunderstanding of what the implications are of what's happening.
No, that's fair enough. However, obviously, while you say it's not property has not been as integrated with the financial system, nonetheless, there's been a fair amount of off-balance sheet lending, the shadow banking system by financiers or financing institutions, most of them connected with regional or local governments, which get a lot of their taxes from property development. That might, would you agree, lead to some problems with the government needing to write that off and the banking system perhaps having to have a bit of a restructuring?
There will be losses, for sure. And just like I wouldn't invest much in a lot of, you know, in a property market on large, I also wouldn't invest in a lot of the banks. They will also feel some pain But you know, again, they're not as integrated. There's no there's not this massive pool of asset-backed financial instruments that are deeply integrated and an unknown that is going to cause some mass panic and hysteria like we saw in 2008, which incidentally was really a creation of bad government regulation with mark-to-market accounting. But these are causes for slowdowns, not crashes.
Yep.
And so the hysteria over it, I think, is just a little bit misplaced.
Now, one of the things you did mention as maybe being a serious cause for concern was expatriation. That is essentially emigration by a portion of some of the upper and rising middle classes. How serious is that, and why are they doing it?
This is potentially much more serious, in my opinion. There's a recent survey interviewed a whole bunch of rich people in China, and found that more than 60% of them were either already emigrating or were planning to do so. And their main reasons for doing so were core quality of life issues, and I call this the quality of life brain drain. That people are leaving because the air is too polluted, they're worried about tainted food, and they can't educate their children to the standards that they want to. And they're mostly emigrating to the United States, but also quite a bit to Canada and Australia, Europe, and other developed markets where they can find better services, for their families. And this is not something to hit the panic button on, but this is the sort of the slow bleeding that can happen to an economy that doesn't meet the expectations of a rising middle class.
Yeah, that's a very valid point indeed, and certainly looking at Vancouver property prices and the west coast of Canada, you can certainly see the effect of mainland Chinese money. Just to finish up here, though, would you say, Adam, that if you've got exposure to China, which obviously you do if you own a BRIC fund or a more regionally focused fund, what would be the appropriate course of action? What should you be looking for in the way that your managers are running the fund? What type of sectors should they be looking to get exposure to? One would imagine they don't want exposure to things like construction or banking, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and that puts us back to a refrain that we often you talk about almost every show, and I don't think any informed managers would disagree with, which is don't buy passive, but don't do it in China especially. The yep. index is dominated by as they are in most emerging markets, the old money that is not necessarily where the new growth is going to be. And in China, that's particularly true because it's mostly the big state-owned banks that have those big exposures. And it's no mistake that despite that the consumer economy in China is growing with 15 to 20% a year, all the major ETFs on China are down at least 3, if not 10% so far this year. This is a place where an active manager who's especially one if one can be fairly informed on, if not a specialist on China, would really pay off.
Now, that's certainly a point, as you say, that we do stress, because these aren't efficient markets for a start. And secondly, as you say, the largest companies tend to reflect the older, old established sectors of the economy. But therefore, would it be fair to say it's not so much a question of selling your China investments as making sure that they actually have exposure to the parts of the Chinese economy that you want to be exposed to?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The tougher question is how much relative to your other investments do you put into China, and there I think it depends on what kind of you're much more to do with the individual investor. But absolutely, there's a parts of the market that are growing much as strong as anything in the world. As strong as, many frontier markets and whatnot in terms of the consumer economy. So there's, I know of two or three stocks in China that are up 250% over the past year and are, quite large enough to be investable by major investors. So, there's lots of opportunities.
Thanks so much indeed, Adam. That was Adam Chopin of the FIS Group in Philadelphia. I imagine we'll be speaking to him once again in the not-too-distant future because there are a couple of very interesting points coming out of that discussion, especially the quality of life emigration that you're seeing amongst well-educated Chinese. Just before we go to the break, it might seem difficult to imagine an oil-rich company in the Middle East having money problems, but we talk about one such possibility in the current edition of the EFMI newsletter, that's Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. We suggest what that possibility might mean for investments in the region, and indeed a major passive investment people use to get exposure there. To find out more, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. You could also call 888-287-8229, or you can buy it immediately at our discounted price of $94.99 by going to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter/buy. We'll be talking about Eastern Europe, especially the after effects of the Russia-Ukraine crisis when we come back for the break. Cheers.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
My name's Ken, and I am as general a contractor as you'll find. I do
kitchen remodeling, additions, plumbing, painting. Ken does it all. And I'm Mandy,
the owner of the UPS store in my neighborhood. And Mandy here does it all, too. She
handles Ken's packing and shipping. Because when you're remodeling a bathroom and a client
changes their mind on a light fixture or a mirror, Mandy packs it up and ships it out. She also
helps Ken promote his business, like with these new brochures we printed, new business cards.
And the flyers are great, too. In fact, when I'm at a job and I'm expecting a delivery,
I sign for it. I even let him know with a text or email.
Since I got a mailbox at the UPS store. I have to say, as much as I love being on my own, I'm not alone. I've got Mandy here.
To help with the heavy lifting?
Well, figuratively speaking.
To find a locally owned center near you, visit theupsstore.com. We love small businesses. We love logistics. The UPS store franchise locations are independently owned and operated. Services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary by location. See center for details.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Now, we were talking about one of the major BRIC economies before the break in China. Now we're looking at the fallout from what's been happening with another of the BRIC economies, to wit, Russia, which, as you know, has been a market we've been looking at fairly closely over the last few weeks and months as the Ukraine situation has developed. John Derrick, who is one of our regular guests from U.S. Global Advisors in San Antonio, Texas, is here to talk with us about which markets in Eastern Europe and the surroundings have actually been benefiting from what's been happening with Russia and Ukraine. Welcome back, John.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
Not at all. Now the Russia-Ukraine crisis has cooled off, apparently following the Ukrainian presidential election and an outcome which Russia appears willing to accept. Is there anything in that situation that could lead us to believe it could flare up again, or is it probably as stable as it has been since the takeover of the Crimea?
You know, actually, I think it's about as stable as it's been. And I think the interesting thing is that I think everyone is going to walk away from it. And when I say everyone, meaning, you know, the West broadly and Russia, are going to walk away and saying we won. And, whereas I think the West will, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some peace agreement and Russia's involved and, maybe some of the things that are going on in Eastern Ukraine settle down, et cetera. And then the West will claim victory. And then at the same time, Russia still has Crimea, which nobody seems to be talking about anymore.
Yep.
And so they can claim victory as well. And, you know,
honor is satisfied on both sides. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And Putin will bide his time and maybe pick a different time to do something. But that's kind of how I think is probably the most likely scenario at this point. And the fact that, you know, the West is essentially funding, Ukrainian gas purchases, and so the Russians are getting paid through, you know, with Western money, and so everyone's happy, seems like, not sure it's a great outcome, but that's what's happened.
No, well, it's certainly not as bad as people feared it might have been. However, as the dust settles now, there's obviously been some winners and maybe some losers as well. Which European countries or which countries in the region which you cover seem to have the greatest potential and have benefited the most from what's been happening?
Yeah, on that, I think Poland's been a beneficiary. I think it's viewed literally as a safe haven in the region, stable economy, stable political environment, benefiting from European recovery, et cetera. Actually doesn't really have that much trade with Russia. And so I think Poland's definitely been a beneficiary. And then I think the other, regions that have benefited are, I think Turkey has benefited from it. And I think that's more from a money flow standpoint. If you were worried about what was going on in Russia and some of the longer term implications, I think money flowed into places like Turkey. I think money also flowed into places like Greece, because I think a lot of the international investors, tend to be regional investors. And within that region, there'd shift allocations into places like Turkey, which has been a very strong performer this year, and I think part of that is money coming out of Russia.
No, I mean, that's a very fair point, because as you say, if you're running a dedicated Eastern European fund, and Russia has been overwhelmingly the largest weight within that, although a fair number of people were underweight because of even before Crimea, because of concerns about governance and the like. Nonetheless, where are you going to go? And Turkey is obviously a major market which has been performing well. And I think you, some of the other reasons you like it included the demographics as well as the government's pro-business attitude.
Exactly. I think if you just take a step back and look at the long-term kind of secular growth, demographics are very positive, kind of entrepreneurial culture in Turkey, we talked about this before, but good government policies, generally speaking, toward business development, toward foreign investors, and basically business can get done, businesses can be created, and all those kind of things that are very positive that I think most Americans can relate to. And I think that's just very positive in the long run. And as we've discussed as well, I mean, it's still an emerging market country, and they'll do some things that you'll kind of look at and scratch your head a little bit, like ban Twitter or Facebook or things like that. But the political situation has definitely calmed down. And so I think, you know, the long-term secular story for Turkey is probably that's the best long-term secular story in the region. And I think that's what you want to kind of hit your wagon to, over the long run.
Absolutely. Now, I know that maybe one or two eyebrows will have been raised amongst our listeners by you regarding or mentioning that Greece has been seen as a safe haven, but you were very right in very early in picking Greece as a market that had some very positive changes taking place. Do you want to just briefly recap that and where we are now?
Sure. So Greece, you know, coming out of a recession, so 6 years into a recession, finally starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. They've made some significant structural changes. Essentially, the banking system has been consolidated down. There's now four major players there. They actually all in the last month or so have recapitalized, raised money. That actually put some pressure on the Greek market and the Greek banks in particular, over the last month or so, but they've already rallied back from that. And I think the idea is that it now puts them on a much firmer footing, banking system can function more properly, and you can actually start seeing, you know, real growth coming. I think the other thing along with that is ECB has been very supportive, the ECB announced, a TARP-like program where you can get long-term funding, like 4 year, essentially like a 4 year repo at, right. Currently at 25 basis points. I think that's going to be positive for peripheral banks in general, whether it's Greece or Spain or Italy or whoever. So that should be supportive of lending. They've also talked about doing a securitization program, or maybe down the road you get some kind of QE where there's even more support there. So all those kind of incremental things are very positive for Greece. Then you're just starting to see, like I said, after 6 years of a recession, you finally just start coming out of it. It's just almost like a natural cycle. It just doesn't stay bad forever. That's still the case. I think that's going to continue for the next, kind of foreseeable future, at least 12, 18 month kind of horizon anyway.
Mm-hmm. Which is about as long as one can look ahead in the world of investment, especially with exciting things like the Ukrainian crisis happening. Briefly, in terms of those countries which maybe don't look as attractive?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, no, go ahead. We're going to let you finish.
I was just going to say that, presumably there are some countries, maybe the Baltic republics, which are seen as being more vulnerable given what happened with Crimea and the Ukraine.
Yeah, definitely. I think the Baltics, there's concern there that Russian kind of expansionism is going to continue, and will NATO really defend those countries if Russia tries to kind of exert their influence in those regions or cause, other issues. So, definitely I think those have been areas that have been hurt by it, because I think they're viewed as the next domino, if you will. So I think that's an area that, it has been hurt by it. Obviously, those are not big markets and those kind of things, limited investment opportunities, but definitely I think, they've been negatively impacted by that. And I think to a certain extent, I think all the, former Soviet republics, at some level are a little tainted by it, because people aren't really sure what the Russians' ultimate goals are here, what they're really trying to accomplish, and are they done, or are they trying to recreate the Soviet Union? Those kind of thoughts. So whether it's Kazakhstan or whatever, but
I mean, Armenia actually Georgia, a short success, unsuccessful war with Russia, last Olympics but one. That there is sort of a track record here. Just to finish up, though, in terms of talking about military action, just before we came on, you were mentioning what's been happening in Iraq, where an Al-Qaeda-linked group has taken over the second major city, Mosul, in Iraq, and led to hundreds of thousands of its inhabitants fleeing. Maybe that's going to have some effect on next-door neighbor Turkey?
Yeah, so the Turkish market is down about 3% today, currency's down 1% or so. Obviously it sounds like the situation in Iraq, and I'm not that close to it, but it sounds like the situation is deteriorating pretty rapidly. I mean, that's a pretty significant development. I think the idea, Turkey is responding to that instability in that, are we going to have another Syria type situation? Is this are you going to have another civil war or some other conflict? Or it just shows the instability of the Iraqi government. And whereas the Kurdistan region, I think in the far north, is more stable, but anyway, it just raises a lot of questions about what's happening there and what's going to be the impact for Turkey. Obviously, there's a fair amount of trade that goes across there, oil pipelines that they finally really have gotten up and running, particularly in the North Kurdistan region, sending oil to Turkey. I know there's still some controversy about who's going to buy it and all these things because they don't have an agreement with the central government. But nevertheless, I think there's oil and gas and all those kind of things that are going on that are good for Turkey in the long run, should lower their cost. And so if that gets disrupted, that's a problem. So I kind of look at today's developments as probably likely a buying opportunity in Turkey. The market has probably overreacted. And the markets had a big run. So the fact that we're kind of pulling back here, I think to me is probably a reasonable, use this as an opportunity, is kind of how I'm thinking about it.
No, that makes a lot of sense, John. And again, very much appreciate your thoughts on some of the beneficiaries and maybe some of the possible losers from what's been happening with Russia and Ukraine. But as always, as you say, the continuing uncertainty about what Russia's long-term aims are inevitably has to cast a little bit of a doubt on the valuation that you would give even for very attractive businesses in regions which happen to border it. We'll, I'm sure, be back to talk to you about this again in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, great. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks. And just before we go to break, before we do so, as I mentioned, if you actually wanted to get some more detail about what's been going on with the Ukrainian crisis, what it means longer term for investments in that region, our current edition of the EFMI newsletter has some thoughts from us on what's been happening and what might happen. Please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. When we come back, it'll be the second part of a conversation with one of our regular contributors, Mark Townsend, on the line from Dubai to talk about what's been happening with the Vietnamese economy, which has been voted by some the most attractive frontier market out there. There are some problems, and we'll be talking about them with Mark when we come back.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Moving to another region that has a potential conflict brewing, I have journalist editor Mark Townsend on the line from Dubai, who has been a regular contributor to the program and an important contributor to our book, Investing in Frontier Markets, available from all good bookstores and Amazon.com. Now, having recently researched a detailed article on Vietnam for Euromoney magazine, we spoke to him last week about some of the problems that are emerging in the Vietnamese economy, and he's back with us to do the second part of this discussion. Welcome back, Mark.
Good to be with you, Gavin. Thank you.
Thanks. Now, since you were here last week, the tensions between Vietnam and China that we talked about in the South China Sea have heated up somewhat. Can you give us an update?
Certainly. There's obviously been an escalation in tensions. That's really coming about. And they've been mutually ramming each other for the last few weeks. That seems to have slightly dissipated now, Gavin. And the news is today that I think two strands, really, that first of all, that the UN, the United Nations, has offered to mediate in the dispute between Vietnam and China. But perhaps a little bit more of a concern is that that Vietnam is now suggesting that China has sent around six warships to the area, which has been flatly denied by China. Vietnam is saying that the rig, which is, you know, in fairly close proximity to the Paracel Islands, is being moved and shifted. And of course, both sides are extremely nervous. And when you add into that the sort of accusations which are flying around about the, you know, the U.S. Is involvement and Vietnam asking the U.S. to play a more active role. You know, it's a sort of worrying melange of ingredients, which I think could take an unexpected twist potentially. If there is any substance in the sort of accusation that the warships have been sent, that obviously would be a substantial escalation, Gavin.
Yes, I'm just fascinated by your comment there that the Vietnam has been asking the U.S. to get more involved. Who would have thought it, even
indeed,
as recently?
Absolutely.
But one suggestion has been that Vietnam has been using this dispute as a distraction from the economic problems at home. Last week we talked about the state of the banking system in Vietnam, where there's a lot of bad debts, and that the Vietnamese asset management company, which is supposed to be buying the bad debts off the banks, which are largely state-owned or state-controlled, doesn't really have the balance sheet to do so. Would it be fair to say that the banking system and lending in general in Vietnam to small and medium-sized businesses, which create the most jobs and the most economic dynamism, is being held back by the bad loans that we discussed?
Definitely. I mean, I think that the one of the issues that came out very strongly when I was looking at the piece that I wrote recently was that lending to the SME sector was very, very low indeed, and given the fact that Vietnam is heavily reliant on its export sector, that's quite worrying. And despite that, and in the face of that, the export sector is really significantly supporting the economy, and it's able to take advantage of much lower wages than China. So you've got this sort of shift, if you like, away from manufacturing in China, which Vietnam has so expertly picked up. And you have to sort of tip your hat to the success and the sustainability of its export performance. It's actually outperformed most of the rest of Southeast Asia, and particularly ASEAN, until very recently. Philippines has just taken over the top slot. But it's the duration, I think. And but that is not enough in itself to sort of stave off what is effectively a de facto banking crisis, Gavin.
No, I mean, that is, and as you said, the export sector has been doing extremely well, possibly connected with the sharp reductions in Vietnam's tariffs since it joined the World Trade Organization in 2007. I mean, the Vietnamese asset management company is really simply not up to the task. I think some major observers of Vietnam have said, people like Mark Mobius from Templeton, and the Moody's analyst has been very sort of critical, I believe, of the way that Vietnam's been treating this bad debt problem.
Indeed, they have. When I spoke with Mark Mobius, I mean, he was very, very, he didn't sort of take any hostages. I mean, he said that what he just defined as reckless and excessive lending to state-owned enterprises. And of course, within that context, Gavin, there's all the cross-holdings within the various Vietnamese companies, which means it's a very opaque issue to try and unravel, particularly for foreign investors, if they were to have any piece of the action coming out of this. But I think the other thing is that the instability, the economic instability, is reflected in bond prices. I mean, in April, as recently as April, yields on the 10-year government bond were a staggering 9.5%. And that's only second to emerging Asia, Pakistan in emerging Asia, which has a higher yield, around about 11%. So, it's the issues are stacking up. And one of the other fundamental issues about the VAMC is the fact that it's only been capitalized with $24 million. So quite how it bails out such a large amount of non-performing loans and how that debt would be finally auctioned off is, very, very difficult to discern. And there's very little information coming out. So, the issues that are going on in the South China Seas are a little bit of a distraction, as you said earlier, and you can't help that the fact that the Vietnamese government is upping the ante is possibly associated with that too, Gavin.
Okay, Mark. Well, that's a very clear summary of some of the potential problems that Vietnam faces, that which may threaten its status as one of the most, if not the most, attractive frontier markets. Thank you very much indeed for that that two-part discussion of what is a major banking crisis in Vietnam, and we'll have to see how it works out. I'm sure we will discuss this again with you, Mark, in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks, Gavin.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And our thanks to journalist editor Mark Townsend in Dubai. Our next guest has a specific analysis of investing in Africa, in another country that may be a major beneficiary from the rising cost of labor in China, in this case, Ethiopia. I have Africa consultant Aubrey Harubi on the line from Washington with a report on how to make the most of investing in Ethiopia. This is a subject we touched on briefly a few weeks back, but Aubrey was actually in Ethiopia last week on a research trip and suggests that the best way to play Ethiopia right now is probably through multinational corporations who have activities there. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, Aubrey.
Thank you, Gavin. It's a pleasure.
Not at all. Well, firstly, and forgive me if this sounds a little bit of a blunt question, but why should investors bother with Ethiopia in the first place?
I think the fundamentals are very, very strong. And as you said, the trend lines for the move of manufacturing away from China to countries like Ethiopia are also very promising. You see, Ethiopia's been growing GDP over 9% over the last 4 years and is expected to hit about 8% this year. It's a large market, 90 million people, and slowly the manufacturing sector is growing as a percentage of GDP. And so those investors who are looking for kind of access to the consumer goods play in Africa certainly want exposure to Ethiopia as a large market.
No, I mean, that again is something that people just are not aware of, and certainly I wasn't until I started doing the work with Al Emid on the Frontier Markets book, that Ethiopia has 90 million people, which I think, would that make it the second largest country by population after Nigeria? So
yes.
We know from earlier conversations that we've had, and our listeners do, that it's not Africa as one market, it's a bunch of individual countries with a different approach for different countries. But just to reinforce the point, most of the multinational companies that you would recommend are ones which investors in North America or Europe could fairly easily purchase because they're listed in the major exchanges, whereas trying to buy domestic Ethiopian companies would be very difficult.
Correct. And so, as you said, the best strategy for increasing an investor's exposure to Ethiopia is to invest in companies like Heineken, which recently opened a $150 million production facility in Ethiopia, Unilever, which is planning a $150 million facility. Samsung has just opened a printer assembly plant. They just commissioned it last week while I was there. And both Procter & Gamble and GE are looking to do manufacturing in Ethiopia, though their plans are less set. The other area where I was looking into in depth in Ethiopia is the manufacturing of apparel, garments. They're trying to build out the factories just as Vietnam and other companies have, or other countries have, taken the jobs outside of China. And there are several major retailers sourcing from Ethiopian factories. So you can really gain exposure to the growing manufacturing success of Ethiopia through companies like H&M and Tesco. Those are the two major European buyers of Ethiopian apparel.
Now, those are certainly some very well-known and well-recognized names. Obviously, at the moment, Ethiopia is a fairly small proportion, but Africa getting to be a larger proportion. So would it be fair to assume that we might actually see at some point in the next decade a time when Ethiopia could be rivaling Vietnam or Bangladesh as a manufacturing center?
Absolutely. The plans the government has as part of their growth and transformation plans are aggressive. They're building out $1.3 billion worth of infrastructure to support the manufacturing sector. Turkish companies have invested hundreds of millions in integrated factories that produce yarn, weaving, textiles, all the way up to garments. And so you're really seeing the development of an industrial cluster. The shoe industry has also grown up alongside it, with major investments from Chinese companies who are looking for other avenues to produce to export to the United States. So there's a major shoe facility in Ethiopia that's exporting, millions of dollars of shoes at this juncture to the U.S. and plans to double in size soon.
So, just to finish up here then, Aubrey, you know, things are changing. But again, it's fair to stress the point that given the difficulty of investing in domestic Ethiopian companies, or maybe even some of the Turkish companies you mentioned, which have been building up the garment business, really the most effective way of getting exposure would be the developed world multinationals with a strong presence, and that we're actually seeing some real money, as you mentioned, Heineken with $150 million investment, and Tesco and H&M actually with facilities on the ground.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed, Aubrey. And it's fascinating information, because these are not really markets that are even on the frontier market radar screen yet. But at the same time, as you point out, a very large market and with a very high rate of growth. So certainly something that potential investors should be aware of. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again about other African markets in the not too distant future.
Thanks so much, Gavin. It's always a pleasure.
And you. Thanks to our African consultant, Aubrey Harubi, in Washington after a trip to Ethiopia, where she saw some of the multinational investments on the ground in that country of 90 million people. It really is striking to remark how many large domestic markets there are, which may well have a large export component, but at the same time, as with China and India, and Brazil, you may well see a very large domestic market growing as well, which makes them somewhat insulated from a downturn in world trade. We're going to break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other large market in sub-Saharan Africa, that is Nigeria, with our African correspondent Samuel Okoja in Lagos, Nigeria. The Nigerian market's been attracting a lot of cash, partially due to the rebalancing of the frontier market indices, with Qatar and the UAE being promoted to emerging market status. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I mentioned before we went to the break, having looked at one major African market in the form of Ethiopia with its 90 million people, we're now going to the largest country in Africa, both in terms of population. It has 170 million people or thereabouts, and also in terms of the size of its economy, which was recently, after a recalculation of its GDP, found to be substantially larger than South Africa. I'm talking, of course, about Nigeria, and we have our Africa correspondent Samuel Okoja on the line from Lagos, Nigeria. Welcome back, Samuel.
Thank you so very much, Gavin. It's great to be here once again.
Now, the last time we were speaking about Nigeria, the kidnapping of more than 100 young girls by the Islamic militant group Boko Haram was in the international news, although it's faded somewhat. Could you give us an update on the terrorism situation there? And is there anything in the developments we've seen that leads one to believe Boko Haram can be dealt with or defeated?
Well, with the stories we have on ground here, I must confess that the violence unleashed by Boko Haram continues. As a matter of fact, just a few days back, we had a story about another abduction of about 20 young women in the northeast of the country. And so with this kind of stories, you begin to wonder if we will have any succor to the problem. But as it is right now, we've got international efforts trying to help the government here to tackle the problem. And so with this international effort, one is believing that very, very soon we should be able to be talking about a solution to the problem. But as it is right now, Boko Haram continues to unleash violence on people, especially those within the northeast of the country. So it's very difficult to talk about an end in sight. Now, what we can say is that we remain optimistic that efforts being made to end the problem will yield fruitful results.
So despite the continuing militancy by Boko Haram and further incidents such as you mentioned, as I was discussing coming into the this portion, funds are actually flowing into the Nigerian stock market. What's been driving that?
Interestingly, Nigeria has been receiving a large influx of in foreign portfolios in spite of concerns over the terror campaign of Boko Haram. After a closely tracked index provider increased significantly the weight of Africa's largest economy. MSCI, whose indices are followed by billions of US dollars from institutional investors, has lifted the weight of Nigeria's equity market on its popular MSCI Frontier Markets to about 19%, up from 12% previously. The increase is channeling about $200 million in fresh foreign flows on top of further domestic flows, driving the Lagos-based stock market to a four-month high. The annual rebranding of the index has sharply increased trading volumes in Lagos.
And are there any indication of the size of the volumes in Lagos, Samuel?
Yep.
I'm sorry, we lost you there briefly for a moment, but I think you were saying, what, about $70 million US dollars of shares changing hands?
Yes, yes, at the end of last week, last week at the exchange in Lagos. That's triple the usual level, according to brokers. And if I might answer your question directly, what has been driving that? Of course, Nigeria is a frontier market that's attracting a lot of attention because of its growing youth population. A lot of people have been talking about the expanding middle class. These are some of the reasons why it appears investors are finding Nigeria a very, very irresistible place to invest in.
And presumably that's been helping the Nigerian currency, the Naira, as well.
Absolutely. The fresh foreign portfolio flows has really helped the Nigerian Central Bank to stabilize the exchange rate of the local currency, the Naira, against the dollar. Earlier this year, the currency suffered after the suspension of the head of Nigeria's Central Bank, forcing the bank to intervene heavily in the market. Hard currency reserves had fallen from about $50 billion in mid-2013 to roughly about $37 billion recently as the central bank intervened. But following the reweighing, Nigeria is the second largest constituent in the MSCI Frontier Index after Kuwait. It might interest you to know that the index is tracked by $6 billion in institutional money.
So just starting to finish up here, Samuel, obviously oil has been one of the reasons that the multinationals have been investing in Nigeria directly, apart from the portfolio investment flows following the MSCI Frontier Market. But at the same time, as you were mentioning, the youthful population and the growing middle class seem to be attracting from other American and European multinationals.
Absolutely. Interestingly, Nigeria is actually There was this list that came out recently about the countries that have been attracting the most interest from Europe and America, and Nigeria came up tops. It emerged as the frontier market economy that's attracting the most attention from American and European multinationals. Of course, Nigeria is joined by Argentina and Vietnam as the frontier markets that multinational corporations are most interested in. That's according to a new index of corporate sentiment. The Frontier Market Sentiment Index, created exclusively for the Wall Street Journal by Washington, D.C.-based advisory firm Frontier Strategy Group, tracks the level of interest shown by major European and American multinational companies in countries across the frontier markets. A youth population, high economic growth rates, and an expanding middle class, like I said earlier, have drawn investors to frontier markets in recent years, leading them to significantly outperform emerging and developed markets in terms of returns. And Nigeria is at the top of that rank as far as frontier market is concerned.
Well, Samuel, that's all positive and good news. Just briefly as a last question, while that picture is positive, are there any threats to the continued flows of investment funds? We talked about Islamic militancy and Boko Haram. Is there anything on the horizon apart from that that might deter investors looking at Nigeria?
Yeah, corruption. The challenge we have right now is corruption, high startup costs, poor infrastructure, and incoherent regulation, and sometimes weak governance. These are some of the issues that might affect continued flow of investments. Governments will need to tackle these problems to further boost confidence and increase the growth opportunities we have.
Okay, well, that's a good survey of reasons why people are investing in Nigeria and attracted to it, and also one or two of the issues they have to consider on the other side. We'll be back talking to you again, I know, Samuel, in the not-too-distant future.
Good to be with you this time, and looking forward to the next appearance.
Thanks so much. Samuel Okoja, our African correspondent, speaking to us from Lagos, Nigeria. And again, it's a very valid point. One of the issues with passive investment is that when the indices change, you will get flows driven by people following the index. Nigeria has been a big beneficiary of that. So today we've covered China, the aftermath of the Russia-Ukraine crisis, Vietnam, Ethiopia, and Nigeria. Next week I'll be back with our global roster of contributors and other reports that are looking at emerging and frontier markets and the opportunities and sometimes the dangers that can be associated with investing in them. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We're the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, now available in English-speaking markets around the world, and Frontier Markets for Dummies, both of which have made their appearance on the Amazon.com and other websites. We are the publishers of the FMI newsletter I mentioned during the program. We think that with this radio program, our books, and the newsletter, we're one of the leading sources of information about emerging and frontier market investing. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks. Join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.